beaucoup. La traduction était absolument parfaite. Et donc j'en profite pour vous remercier, Anne, Laurence, de m'inviter, de nous inviter à parler dans ce séminaire. J'en suis vraiment très heureux. Et bon, maintenant, je vais donc vous parler en anglais. Je ne savais pas d'ailleurs quelle était la langue de travail de votre séminaire, mais donc on a choisi l'anglais. And my presentation today will take the form of a question, or more precisely, maybe three questions. Three questions focusing on some of the most important words in my title, Progressive, Republic, and Letters, and I'm going to explain why or what I mean by that. But first, perhaps a few words about Francis Bacon and his reputation as a thinker. As is often the case with overtowering intellectual figures, or artistic figures for that matter, Bacon's reputation as a prophetic thinker peaked long after his death. That is to say, in France at least, towards the end of the 18th century. Among the French encyclopedists, Diderot was one of Bacon's most fervent admirers, and so was Alexandre Dolaire, who went as far as twisting Bacon's thinking the better to appropriate him, Bacon, as a forerunner of the Enlightenment. As explained by Jean-Baptiste de Vauzel in his Histoire de la vie et ouvrage de François Bacon, comme on disait à l'époque, in an early 19th century book dealing with Bacon's life and philosophy. And you can see that Vauzel calls Dolaire un élégant paraphraste mêlant trop souvent ses pensées à celles de son auteur, que souvent même il dénature avec ou sans dessein. On sent qu'il est continuellement préoccupé du désir de placer la philosophie du XVIIIe siècle sous la protection d'un grand nom. Par exemple, en lisant cette analyse, on serait tenté de croire que Bacon était au moins déiste, tandis qu'il était fort bon chrétien et zélé protestant. If the Enlightenment is defined in very broad strokes as a philosophical movement stressing the importance of reason and the critical reappraisal of existing ideas and social institutions, then maybe Dolaire's reading of Bacon's philosophy was not so misguided after all. Or was it? And it is the question I'd like to ask today. In this paper, I will aim at exploring some of the political and philosophical tensions which I believe shape and inform most of Bacon's writings, including his essays and his New Atlantis, and especially when these writings are read side by side in an attempt to compare or maybe conflate them. Bacon was one of the major influences of the founders of the Royal Society at the end of the 17th century, as I'm sure you know. And in light of the way Bacon's thinking influenced so many intellectual enterprises between the late 17th century and the early or even late 18th century, and also because Bacon never tired of insisting on the need to advance knowledge, the notion of a progressive republic of letters seems to encapsulate the spirit of his philosophy. Yet, I will try to show that each of the words that make up this catchy phrase is potentially problematic. I will start with the word letters, and I will work my way down to the word... backwards to the word progressive. Focusing also on the word republic. And while doing so, I will also try to explore the three notions at the heart of today's session, namely knowledge, disciplinarity, and of course progress, with a view to suggesting that their bringing together sometimes makes for some conceptual friction within Bacon's philosophy. So first, the tension between scientific and literary knowledge, or more simply put, between science and literature. It is hard to deny that Bacon was instrumental in furthering the Republic of Letters, if only because his thought influenced so many collective intellectual enterprises, the most famous of which being, of course, the foundation of the Royal Society, as I've already explained. Yet, although Bacon was a great stylist, and although he tried his hand at some theatrical pieces in his early days, he was neither a playwright nor a poet in the true sense of the words.
His greatest claim to fame, as well as his reputation as a philosopher, rest on his ambitious plan for the reform of science. As a proponent of scientific progress, it may therefore seem odd to associate his name with Republic of Letters. We would expect something more like the Republic of Science or Sciences. His vision for the founding of a Royal Society or a scientific commonwealth would probably strike us as a more appropriate description of his philosophical enterprise. Conversely, speaking of Bacon's vision of a progressive Republic of Letters sounds all the more surprising for Bacon's repeated repudiation of bookish learning. One of the few things many people know about Bacon is the fact that he rejected bookish learning, books, knowledge based on books. In No Morganum, for example, one of his most famous works, Bacon keeps lashing out at speculative philosophers and book-based knowledge. But it is important to understand that Bacon is very much a bookish philosopher himself. For all his reservations about and critique of the ancients, especially Aristotelian philosophy, he also makes abundant use of them in his works. Not all Bacon's comments on Aristotle are derogatory, far from it. For example, in The Advancement of Learning, you have the title page here on this slide, and here is the passage I'd like us to take a look at. So in The Advancement of Learning, he praises Aristotle's moderation while contrasting it with Pliny's rash judgment, as you can see. But the produce, and he's talking about Aristotle, but the produce and integrity of Aristotle is here worthy our observation, who, having compiled an exact history of animals, dashed it very sparingly with fable or fiction. But even Pliny is given the occasional accolade, which suggests that Bacon did not aim at rejecting books altogether, but rather at striking a balance between knowledge garnered from literary sources on the one hand and knowledge based on the direct, unmediated study or observation of nature on the other hand. This is particularly obvious, I think, in the following extract from another of his works, The New Atlantis. Again, you have the title page here on the slide. And in this scientific utopia, perhaps you're familiar with the work, Bacon describes a scientific college presiding over the fate of a nation, Ben Salim, and the scientists are responsible for making this nation happy, more prosperous, healthier, wealthier, and they are really presiding over their future and destiny. And these scientists, Bacon explains, maintain a trade not for gold, silver, or jewels, nor for silks, nor for spices, nor any other commodity of matter, but only for God's first creature, which was light. To have light, I say, of the growth of all parts of the world. And how do they maintain such a trade for light? Well, precisely by reading books. Not just books, though, but also knowledge based on natural historical facts and knowledge or information gleaned from books. So they achieve such knowledge by collecting both natural historical facts and intelligence about, I quote, the sciences, arts, manufactures, and inventions of all the world. So they read books and roam the world searching for facts. The direct observation of and experiment on nature supplement the reading of books. They do not replace them. In the words of a critic of Bacon, and this is the following quotation, the fact that the methods and even the conclusions of the ancients may be inadequate or inaccurate does nothing to prevent us from seeing that much can still be gleaned from their works through an eclectic approach such as that displayed by Bacon throughout his writings. There is a second reason why it is not possible to say, well, it is possible to say that one should not separate so the sciences from literature. It's more of a historical reason than a theoretical one. It should be remembered that in the early modern period, especially, the scientific was not conceived of as the exotic other of the literary. While this is true from a general point of view, it is clear that the students of Bacon's philosophy should be particularly cautious about driving a wedge between science and literature. There are at least two main reasons for this. First, as explained in The Advancement of Learning, Bacon believes that the distributions and partitions of knowledge should not be seen as absolute, but they should be accepted, and I quote his words, as, or rather for lines and veins than for sections and separations, so that the entireness of knowledge can be preserved. As you can see in the quotation from the, in this quotation from The Advancement of Learning. In other words, by separating history from poetry or poetry from philosophy, in other words, literature from science or science from literature, one runs the risk of making knowledge barren, shallow, and erroneous. What Bacon advocates is a comprehensive approach to knowledge, one that does not isolate the individual sciences from the, and I quote, common fountain of knowledge, one that does not separate what we now call science from what we now see as literature. In the early modern period, and in Bacon's thinking especially, rhetoric, poetry, and philosophy were part of the same intellectual continuum. It's the same province or continent of knowledge, and in this within this continent of knowledge you have several provinces, science being one of them, literature being another. So the Republic of Letters therefore also included scientific scholars for the simple reason that early modern botanists, mathematicians or natural philosophers were yet to secede into a disciplinary sphere of their own. And this process of differentiation was to take several decades and even maybe centuries, eventually resulting in the emergence of what C.P. Snow famously called the two cultures in the 20th century. Now, the second reason why it is not possible to separate literature from science, and especially when it comes to Bacon's philosophy, has to do with his philosophical use of literature. As I have argued elsewhere, Bacon's philosophical ideas are sometimes embedded in his fictional prose. Indeed, it is not uncommon for Bacon to use a literary form to convey his philosophical theories. And I'd like to take the example of the Gesta Graiorum, precisely one of the writings I translated into French and which is about to be published next year. This is an early literary piece in which six counselors deliver speeches about the best course of action for a prince to follow. And they're addressing the prince and they're telling him what course of action he should take. And the first counsellor argues in favour of war, and then the others argue successively in favour of philosophy, the building of monuments, absolutism, a virtuous form of government, and finally, a life of leisure. But, and it, the prince decides for the life of leisure at the end of the because it's in the context of a theatrical entertainment, so it makes perfect sense. But as Brian Vickers explains, the speech on behalf of philosophy is a virtual digest of Bacon's lifelong programme for the reformation of scientific research, with some details only reappearing in the posthumously published New Atlantis. In other words, Gesta Graiorum can be read as a blueprint for some of the key ideas which were further developed and conceptualized in the later Novum Organum, or even in the New Atlantis. So in other words, Bacon uses a literary form, a theatrical form, in order to express and perhaps promote his scientific ideas. The New Atlantis is another example of that. So I now come to my second point about Bacon's scientific republic, or republic of letters. I'd like to focus on the word republic. So having dealt with, and I hope successfully explained away, the first tension in my title, the tension between science and letters, which, as I've just argued, is best understood as an anachronistic projection of our modern conception of the disciplines, we can now turn to the second term in the title, namely republic, and we can wonder to what extent it accurately describes Bacon's plan for the reformation of science. And in order to answer this question, I'd like to focus on New Atlantis. Now, on the face of it, there seems to be very little doubt that Bacon's scientific enterprise is very much a collective one. And here I'd like to make a distinction between Bacon and Descartes. Unlike Descartes, for whom the philosophical process by which truth can be attained originates in the absolute certainty of the individual cogito, Bacon's pursuit of truth is predicated on the foundation of this scientific order or scientific college I was talking about, the House of Solomon. According to the governor of the House of Strangers in the New Atlantis, because the narrator and his friends in New Atlantis are welcomed by a governor, the governor of the House of Strangers, and the governor of the House of Strangers tells them all they have to, all there is to know about New Atlantis. And here you have part of his speech about the House of Solomon. "Ye shall understand, my dear friends, that amongst the excellent acts of that king, one above all has the preeminence. It was the erection and institution of an order or society, which we call Solomon's House, the noblest foundation, as we think, that ever was upon the earth, and the lanthorn of this kingdom. It is dedicated to the study of the works and creatures of God." The question, therefore, becomes that of the political nature of that order or society. Bacon never uses the word republic in the book, but in the prefatory note he added to the text before publishing it, his secretary, his personal secretary, William Rawley, uses a different word. He uses the word commonwealth. "To the reader, this fable my lord devised to the end that he might exhibit therein a model or description of a college instituted for the interpreting of nature," and further down you see the word commonwealth, "the best state or mold of a commonwealth." So we have to ask ourselves what exactly he means by that. In the course of the book, Bacon also uses the word commonwealth with reference to Thomas More's Utopia. Now, for obvious historical reasons, the word commonwealth does not carry quite the same connotations today as it did when the book was first published. In the early 17th century, commonwealth was the English equivalent of the Latin res publica, which in turn translated the Greek politeia. It was the most comprehensive way of referring to any type of political community, regardless of whether such a community was of a monarchical, aristocratic, or democratic nature. Yet, to compound matters further, Aristotle also uses the word politeia in a more restricted sense. Although the exact definition of the word is very much a moot point and has generated much debate and controversy among scholars of Aristotle, it is possible to narrow down the uses of the word to two main acceptations, a general one and a restricted one. On the one hand, as I've just explained, politeia refers generically to any form of government or constitution. But on the other hand, Aristotle also makes use of the word politeia in a more specific sense to designate a particular form of government, which is the rule by the many. In Aristotle's opinion, constitutions or systems of government can be classified according to two main principles. First, whether one, a few, or many citizens have a say in the making of the laws, that is the first criterion. And second, whether whoever exercises power does so with only their own interests at heart, which is a vicious form of government, or for the good of all the citizens, which is the virtuous way of exercising power. In other words, in its restricted sense, politeia is the virtuous form of government wherein power is wielded neither by one man, for this is called monarchy, nor by a few men, for that would be aristocracy, but by the many. And it corresponds to what we now call democracy. Now, what about in the Commonwealth in New Atlantis? Well, it is not entirely clear who really exercises power in New Atlantis. Ben Salem, the scientific utopia, that's the name of the scientific utopia, is supposed to be a monarchy. The governor of the stranger's house tells the narrator and his friends that the House of Solomon was founded a long time ago by King Sulamona, an illustrious monarch whose wisdom the Ben Salemites think very highly of. They are also informed that the feast of the family, whenever a father has a certain number of children, he's allowed to organize a feast of the family to celebrate his new status. And this is organized under the tutelage of the king. But the king is never seen. This is an extract from the description of the feast of the family. So the European visitors do not get to meet the king, who, unlike his famous predecessor, King Sulamona, remains unnamed. The current king, I mean current at the time of the narration, is at best a distant figure. His presence makes itself felt indirectly through his seal and through the herald's voice. But the seal is doubly removed from the real king or real thing, as it is nothing more than the image of an image. As Denise Albanese points out, the king's unobtrusive presence gestures towards the possibility of his eventual effacement from the social space of Bacon's utopia. This, of course, carries potentially subversive undertones, especially if one realizes that it is coupled with the pluralization of the figure of the sovereign, as the House of Solomon occupies the position of authority left vacant by the king's disappearance. There is not one sovereign in New Atlantis, but several. The scientists, the College of Scientists. The fellows of the House of Solomon are placed in the position of authority normally occupied by the monarch, a substitution that turns Bin Salem into an aristocratic system of government, possibly even a republican or democratic one, for the scientists are supposed to work for and on behalf of the Bin Salemite people as a whole. It is no surprise if Bacon's New Atlantis was appropriated, and indeed Bacon's thinking was appropriated by some of the most radical thinkers of the mid-17th century, and if Bacon was sometimes acclaimed as a radical thinker by the Republicans in the middle in the mid 17th century. Well, this is the extract from the article I was quoting from. If sovereignty is a matter of sight, the New Atlantis inserts the philosopher of nature into the space of authority. So if one subscribes to such a radical reading of Bacon's utopia, Bin Salem becomes a place purged of any trace of political verticality. And it is interesting to notice that the predominant personal pronoun in the text is not I, but we. We have also a number of artificial wells and fountains. And again, we have little wells for infusions of many things. And amongst them, we have a water which we call water of paradise, being by that we do to it, made very sovereign for health and prolongation of life. However, much as the explicit designation of Bin Salem as a monarchical system of government turned out to be deceptive, so the repeated insistence on the collective construction of truth may very well function as a social and political trompe-l'œil. For when it comes to the pursuit of truth or the making of political decisions, the Bin Salemite people are relegated to a subordinate position, as emerges from their silently watching the father of the House of Solomon parading through the city. The street was wonderfully well kept, so that there was never any army had their men stand in better battle array than the people stood. The windows likewise were not crowded, but everyone stood in them as if they had been placed. And this is the crowd watching silently the parade. So having been thrown out of the monarchical door, verticality creeps back in through the aristocratic window. For all the republican appropriations of Bacon's utopia, it seems fair to say that in New Atlantis the word commonwealth should be taken in its general sense rather than its specific and more egalitarian meaning. Mm. To paraphrase Orwell, all Bin Salemites are equal, but some are clearly more equal than others. Mm. And yet there is also a sense in which New Atlantis lends itself to a more radical reading than Bacon intended, because the king has almost vanished into thin air. Bacon's scientific utopia can be appropriated to unthink kingship, something Bacon certainly did not have in mind when writing New Atlantis. And after all, he described himself in a letter to James in, I think, 1612, as a peremptory royalist. And at the same time, he said that it was never out of favour in the House of Commons. So here you have something of the tension I was talking about, reflected in his own letter. So in that respect, New Atlantis serves as a perfect illustration of Bacon's, or what I'd like to call Bacon's progressive conservatism, or perhaps conservative progressivism, which is my last point. The Oxford English Dictionary defines progressivism as the advocacy of progress, reform, change, or innovation. Now, with such a definition in mind, it is hard to deny that Bacon is a progressive thinker. The very idea of progress, or innovation, features prominently in many of his works, from New Atlantis and No Morgan Woman. Of course, in the title, well, the word, the adjective new, or no, is very significant. But also in the even more explicit Advancement of Learning. Yet, in much the same way as I tried to qualify the previous two notions we've analysed so far, namely that of letters and that of Commonwealth, I would like to insist on a possible spot of ambiguity with regard to Bacon's progressivism. I will obviously not argue that Bacon's plan for the reformation of science was not progressive. That would be too much of a paradox. Although some historians of science have depicted Bacon as a backward thinker, and I'm thinking in particular about Gaston Bachelard, for example, for his failure to adopt a purely rationalist approach to the study of nature. But I will contend that Bacon's political moderation, or should we say perhaps conservatism, also coloured his scientific thinking. Nowhere perhaps is Bacon's cautious faith in progress more visible than in his essay on innovations. Here it is. Well, this is the title page of the essays. As you know, there were many different versions, and this is the essay of innovations. And this is the passage I'd like us to focus on. As Bacon himself explains, change is necessary, if only because time does not stand still. But change is not good or desirable per se. In fact, one would do well to, and I quote, "beware that it be the Reformation that draws on the change, and not the desire of change that pretendeth the Reformation. And lastly, that the novelty, though it be not rejected, yet be held for a suspect. And as the scripture saith, that we make a stand upon the ancient way, and then look about us, and discover what is the straight and right way, and so to walk in it." Progress or innovation is therefore necessary. There is no doubt about that. And one reason for that is because time is the greatest innovator. And if time, of course, alter things to the worse, and wisdom and counsel shall not alter them to the better, what shall be the end? But change must be slow and cautious. The healthy desire for improvement should not become an unhealthy obsession with change. Time and time again, Bacon warns his readers against intellectual rashness. For example, in No Morganum, he contrasts the much desired interpretation of nature with the anticipation of nature. So these should not be mixed up. The interpretation of nature is highly desirable, but the anticipation of nature consists in jumping to conclusions on the basis of a hastily gathered and incomplete collection of natural historical facts. And this, of course, should be rejected. In politics, as in science, therefore, time is of the essence, caution is of the essence. This means, this means that the natural philosopher must learn to strike a balance between her enthusiastic craving for progress and her cautious respect for the past. In Bacon's opinion, neither science nor philosophy can start from scratch. New edifices still need old foundations. This is why Bacon rejects the image of the mind as a wax tablet. There is a crucial difference between the one and the other, and this difference Bacon makes explicit in some of his philosophical texts, including the Redargutio Philosophiarum here. Certainly, on wax tablets you will not write other things unless you will have wiped out the earlier things. In the mind you will scarcely have wiped out the earlier things unless you write in other things. So the old must be surpassed, but this can only be done by letting in the new. The old is therefore required as a foundation. Not only do the received authorities and traditions contain an occasional kernel of truth, and I think I mentioned that in my first point, with the examples of Pliny and Aristotle, but they are also an integral part of the process by which knowledge is to be constructed. In other words, it is better that they should be rejected than that they should never have existed at all. Neither accepted traditions nor a naked desire for new knowledge can suffice if one is to reconstruct the entire intellectual edifice of science. Progress has to be based on tradition. In a sense, old ideas and received theories become weapons of intellectual destruction that the skillful natural philosopher handles in such a way as to turn them against themselves. This is why the merchants of light, of the House of Solomon, do not altogether repudiate the knowledge of all the other nations of the world, although such knowledge is probably very imperfect, but they need it in order to make it possible for science to move forward. They require the past and its errors or half-truths, and being in an ideal natural philosophical state, they're able to take them a step or probably several leagues further towards the genuine light of nature. So to conclude, in this presentation I have tried to constructively deconstruct Bacon's vision of a progressive republic of letters. My aim was to show why such a phrase does not do justice to the complexity of his thought, while still capturing the essence of his philosophy of progress, and especially his strong desire for the reformation of science. My first point was that in Bacon's thinking, as indeed in the early modern period as a whole, I believe, science and literature did not form separate provinces in the continent of knowledge. My second point dealt with the tension between Bacon's aristocratic ethos and the egalitarian, possibly even republican undertones of some of his writings, especially The New Atlantis. While professing to be a peremptory royalist, Bacon's works opened up a space for republican ideas to fill up. And my third and final point was about what I call Bacon's conservative progressivism. While looking ahead of his times and devoting his intellectual faculties to the thinking up of a plan for the reformation of science, Bacon also insisted that the past could not be rejected in one fell swoop, and that one should be careful when innovating. In doing so, I hope I have not strayed away from our main point today. I also hope that I have made some contribution to the general topic of today's session, namely disciplinarity and the progress of knowledge, and I thank you for your attention, and I will be more than happy to continue this conversation with you if you have any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. And there is